is WWR WinWise Radio.
WinWise Radio.
Hi, this is Harley Keisch.
And Susan Lockwood.
And we're coming to you from high atop a not-so-windy mountain in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts.
Tonight, we are honored to welcome Dr. Robert McMurtry. Dr. Robert McMurtry is the founding chair and currently an advisor for the Society for Wind Vigilance. The mission of the Society for Wind Vigilance is to mitigate the risk of both physiological and psychological adverse health effects of industrial wind turbines. In 2011, Dr. McMurtry became a member of the Order of Canada for his leadership and vision in helping to strengthen healthcare delivery in Canada. The Order of Canada is Canada's highest civilian honor.
Well, we're back again, Susan.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are at our deluxe studio. How are you this evening?
Oh, fine.
Yeah? Are you excited tonight?
Yes, I'm very, very excited that we're going to be talking with Dr. McMurtry.
I know. It's really going to be a great show. And I think one of the things that's I hope that we can do is after we're going to have a break about halfway through the show, as we usually do, and we're going to come back, and hopefully some of our listeners will dial in to our phone line. It's 213-943-3683, and they'll talk to our call screener, the lovely Marie, and she will she'll queue up the questions for us, and they can talk with our guest. And that'll be good. There's also a chat room that if people are discovering that, you need to register to use the chat room, or you could use your Facebook registration. The link is right below the chat box. If it doesn't appear on your screen, just refresh your screen, and it should be appearing now. So without further ado and without any more business, I want to say welcome. Dr. McMurtry, are you with us?
I am with you indeed, Harley. Glad to be here, too.
Good evening. Good evening.
Good evening to you and Susan.
Good evening. Susan's looking at me like you asked the first question. So I think the time will fly. So I'm going to start right in. I want to start with just a quick question about the Society for Wind Vigilance, which I understand you were the founding force for. And I want to ask if you could tell all of us about how you got involved with that, how you got involved with the issue of industrial wind and its impacts on not only the health of people that are too close, but also a lot of the other deleterious effects that we find from them.
Well, I think that chronologically it would be sensible to go back to 2008 before the Society for Wind Vigilance. Because at that time, my wife and I were looking to build in our current location in Prince Edward County, and I was interested in having an industrial wind turbine on my property, and that would be January of 2008. And so naturally, when one is considering that, which I had thought, well, goodness, it sounds like a good idea. It's clean, green, and free. And then I began to research it, and the more I researched it, the more concerned I became, and eventually I became alarmed. It was very concerning. And probably a turning point for me was to hear a lecture by John Harris, who Professor Harrison is an emeritus professor of physics from Queen's University, and he showed the physics of why it would be a problem. And it was a very compelling lecture, and I still remember August the 2nd of 2008. And after that, I wrote to all local political people at all levels. That is to say, the municipal level, the provincial, which is similar to state level in the U.S., and the federal member. And I said I was very concerned about what harm might come. I eventually did my first public presentation, the deputation, in November 28, 2008, at which I said that I was concerned because anything I read said there could well be problems and that we should exercise the precautionary principle because we did not know what harm could be done. And at that time, I recommended we have to do the requisite research so we can find the answers to the potential problems. I thought it was a very modest suggestion at the time, but it turned
It seems reasonable, right?
Yeah, I thought it was a very modest suggestion. I didn't take a heavy-duty stand. I simply said, we need to research it. And I could not believe the reaction from the government and from the industry. It made them very angry. And so that was a bit of a turning point, because no matter what happens, they'll say a lot of things, but the one thing they do not want is well-designed research that would answer the questions relating to adverse health effects. They will avoid it and have successfully done so for decades now, because they were in Europe for some time. And there are, of course, complaints in Europe, and they've never done the requisite research. So as I engaged with that, I met a woman named Carmen Krogh, and we began to work together. And Carmen and I were talking one day in early 2010, and she suggested the idea, let's start a society, make it international. And to which I answered, what a nice idea, that's a very good idea. And as a consequence, I became the founding chair and served in that role for 2 years until January 2012. And it's a very exciting group because it involves many disciplines from around the world, based in Ontario, the United States, the United Kingdom, and we have advisors who are more broadly based, Australia, New Zealand, and so forth. So we have, it's an excellent group of people. And I would recommend that your listeners might consider going to just Google Society for Wind Vigils, and you'll be able to judge for yourselves.
Now, one other thing, we're going to put a link up on, I think we actually have it already, but if we don't, we'll definitely put a link on the archive page of the show where people will be able to listen. But that's a fascinating story. I mean, so this has been, let's see, so you say 2005, so am I getting that right? So it's been, you've been involved.
Well, I was thinking about turbines at 2008, 4 years ago.
4 years ago. So
the first few months I thought, I really want to check into this. And then I did research on it and I became really concerned.
Yeah. So I guess I want to think about for a second, and if you ever can direct your attention to some sort of technical medical kind of questions, which is, I mean, you've been involved for a while, and there are a number of, I think, hypotheses and theories about what might be the cause of, you know, people falling ill. It seems like wherever you go in the world, whenever they cite a large industrial wind turbine near too close to someone, whatever too close means, that certain number of people, not everyone, but they start to have some health impacts. So, and then there's the variety of, is it infrasound? Is it, you know, audible sound? Is it a vibroacoustic disease kind of problem? Is it coming from stray voltage? What do we know now? And where do you fall out on all of that? What do you think at this point, knowing what you know?
It's noise energy, both audible and inaudible, that is the principal problem. Stray voltage can also be a problem. So can the oscilloscope kind of effect of blades turning with on-off of the sunlight. But the one that has garnered my attention is the swoosh, 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 to quote Professor Harrison. And that is what disturbs people. What we found in everybody was originally described by Asia Peterson and her co-workers, and that is stress, psychological distress, difficulty initiating, and sleep disruption. And that really says it in a very short way. That is what is occurring. There's every reason to believe, and we have a very good sleep specialist named Chris Hanning, who recently, by the way, produced an editorial for the BMJ about this very subject and noted that there really is a significant issue regarding sleep disruption from his perspective. Others have written on it, and there's a number of candidate possibilities. For example, we had somebody from St. Louis University, George Washington University in St. Louis, who felt that there was the perturbation or disturbance of the cochlea, what he something he called the outer hair cell.
Now, is that Alex Salt that you're talking to?
That's exactly right, Alex Salt.
Okay.
As you know, as well, Dr. Nina Pierpont has postulated that it's highly probable that the vestibular system in the inner ear is what's disturbed. We have a molecular biologist in San Diego who said that there can be interference at a cellular and at a cell signaling level, and this is getting quite technical.
Hmm.
All cells have a property called tensegrity, which it's a gobbledygook word, but it stands for tensile integrity, and that's what stops cells from collapsing. When exposed to vibration, such as that produced by industrial wind turbines, there is the potential of cellular damage. And when you have disturbance of the cytoskeleton within cells, that can interfere with cell signaling. That is the function that goes on in cells that helps it maintain its normal work. So there's been that theory as well. Other people have said that there is vibration of organs. The heart in particular, a lot of people have complained about feeling a sense of vibration affecting their heart and lungs. So there's, finally, I guess you could say, the whole organism. People are very disturbed by what amounts to social injustice because they have no control of what's going on, and this has been forced upon them. And in some jurisdictions like Ontario, the municipalities have lost all control, and it's been forced upon them. So it really can operate at the cellular level or the molecular level, the cellular level, or the organ level, or at the level of a whole person. And lastly, I'd comment, it's typically caused the severe divisions in communities. So community vitality has been disturbed, which too is a determinant of ill health. So which matters the most? I'm going for the whoosh whoosh sound, but I think all the others may be at play as well. What we need is necessary research to make that determination. The governments and the industry, of course, decline to do it.
So I have a question for you, Dr. McMurtry. As you know, Harley and I live in Massachusetts, and Massachusetts, the state, just commissioned a study by the Department of Environmental Protection and the Department of Public Health. And basically, the study just ended up being a literature review, really. They didn't do any study. They just did a literature review. And what they did was pretty much bash every single piece of, well, every single study that claimed there were adverse health effects from wind turbines. So what would you say would constitute a scientifically sound study of these issues that could withstand scrutiny?
Well, I don't think the tobacco industry is yet convinced of the harm of smoking. And I don't know that when you get convene panels, as has been done at least on 10 occasions, and do a literature review, which is incomplete, and then don't do actual research to look at the question of whether or not there are adverse health effects. That strategy has been tried at least 10 times by the industry and working with governments. And it's the same exercise. It's always a literature review, never original research. What should you do to make an actual determination? There is a need for epidemiological studies. The epidemiological studies should compare people close and far from wind turbines. Some of that has been done by Michael Nissenbaum of Maine. And he showed a substantial difference between people within 1,400 meters of industrial wind turbines and those who were at 5,000 meters or more. He's done two studies, and that's available online, by the way. There's been other work that's been done by Daniel Shepard, and it's published in Noise Health, showing a major difference between people, compromise of people's health-related quality of life. That are near turbines, and what he used are standardized questionnaires, so the normal levels have already been defined. To me, these are quite compelling studies. But to make it satisfy the critics, if that's ever possible, I think that you need a substantial number of people who are close to turbines, that is to say within 5 kilometers, and those that are at least 10 kilometers away. And I think compare them to see what the differences are or similarities with standardized questionnaires regarding sleep and standardized questionnaires regarding quality of life. And that would be what we can do. And there's various designs. You can do close and far. You can do before and after implementation. And what also should be done is that people who are within 5 kilometers should be followed from time to time longitudinally, because whilst only a few are early responders, the great fear is with prolonged exposure, increasing numbers will become ill. And I think some people may not even know, for example, that they have hypertension or that their sleep isn't good. That's a well-known fact in sleep studies that are done. So that would be one branch of inquiry. The second branch of inquiry would be actually to evaluate people who are having problems with physiological sleep study. In other words, study their function of sleep. It can be done in sleep labs, but ideally it should be done in their homes. And it is possible to have portable tools that you can take to homes and evaluate people and test them when the turbines are on and test them when they're not. And you could do have a control group that are more than 5 kilometers away from the turbines to see what the results are by comparison. But I think it is a question of doing both epidemiological studies as well as clinical studies, in particular with a focus on sleep.
Well, turning to like the epidemiological studies, now, as I, and obviously we talked earlier in the week, so you know my grasp of the political system in Canada is pretty lame, but as I understand it, is it the government of Ontario that is funding an epidemiological study at the University of Waterloo? Is that correct?
There's a story behind that. What happened was that when we were making presentations before a legislative committee about the Green Energy and Green Economy Act, there was an effort made to, I guess, sort of an olive leaf, I suppose, by the Premier himself.
That's McGuinty, right?
Yeah, that's Premier McGuinty.
Okay.
And actually, he revealed this publicly so I can speak to it. He spoke with me personally and appeared very concerned about my reports of adverse health effects, and I said we'd already accumulated 70 people with that problem. And my understanding, and certainly he said this is why they created the chair. Well, when the Council of Universities did the search for an appropriate person, they ended by picking a man named, let's call him Professor Savothaman. And what he is an expert on the engineering practices related to solar energy.
Right, he's an electrical engineer, he's like a nanotechnology guy, right?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, I'm sorry.
So he doesn't have the expertise. The person he's brought into his research team is Philip Bigelow, and he's going to lead the study. And Philip Bigelow has not got a health professional background, nor is he a clinician scientist. But he's going to do health studies comparing people near and far as I can understand. And that is only just starting to happen. And it's already been 3 years since the Premier announced that professorship. And they won't have a product in all probability for at least another 2 years.
Hmm.
And that really is quite unacceptable in view of the fact that the government is proceeding aggressively to put up turbines. And in a sense, they've managed to do it so that it'll likely be too late.
Right. And I know that Lisa Burns, who's the MPP from Bruce Huron, tried to put a moratorium in effect. She brought a private member's bill, I think, last week, or just earlier this week, actually, that was voted down, right?
Yes, it was. Something like 45-28, because not all were in attendance. I think you're talking about Lisa Thompson.
Lisa Thompson, that's correct, yes.
Yeah, and she did indeed. And it was quite a sight in the legislature, because all the rural members who are largely in the opposition party, and that's because of the last election when rural Ontario turned against the government because of the wind turbine issue and denied them a majority. At any event, their representatives the MPPs and members of the provincial parliament just stood quietly and turned their backs to the government and stood with their backs to the government, clearly wishing to emphasize that the government has turned their backs on the people of rural Ontario.
It's a huge problem. Right, because the cities and the representatives from the cities want to support their lifestyles. They're not near the turbines. Their families aren't being impacted. And they have one perspective. And then, of course, like even where Susan and I live, we live in a very rural area. And Boston doesn't, people on Beacon Hill don't really think about us too much, I guess. We don't have enough votes. Is it the same thing there? Is it just a matter?
Exactly. And that's, the wind industry are very clever about that. They place people in harm who are relatively impotent from an electoral standpoint. They're not going to be able to raise fuss the way it would happen if it were in a city. And they always want to build near rural places because then they can have a low-cost hookup to the electric grid. The province of Ontario has about 1 million square kilometers to the north that are virtually uninhabited. And I don't know why they don't go where people are not, other than they want to be close to where they can get on the grid.
Right, the transmission
so
line problem.
Of rural
right.
communities have been put in harm's way because of this. It's really a business plan. It's not green. It's a business plan.
The only green, we say in the States, the only green is the greed that's involved. So
yes, of the dollars that flow in large. In an earlier discussion today, a mention was made of the fact that these turbines yield something in the neighborhood of $900,000 per turbine per year. And in Ontario at least, what they share with the host is about 1%.
Now, is that $900,000, is that from subsidies or is that from...
Their income.
That's the income from the sale of the electricity that's generated.
Right. They function about 25% of the time in Wolf Island. That's about 70 kilometers to the east of where I live, and which means they have to be backed up because you can't have power sometimes, especially
right.
unpredictable power. And what they have to be backed by is fossil fuel, and usually it's gas. They certainly can't be backed by nuclear. And so as a consequence of gas running, having to run in backup 75% of the time, it actually takes more gas than if the gas were running all the time. So there's no gain to be had by putting up a wind turbine. Marginal. It might be possibly 1%, but it hasn't been proven. The benefits of industrial wind turbines haven't been proven in any sense, whether it relates to employment or economic growth. In fact, the findings tend to suggest the opposite occurs. So I would refer to the Auditor General's report of December 6, 2011 in Ontario, which was extremely critical of the government policies.
So why not a moratorium? Why not a moratorium until some of these issues have been resolved? Is it just the money? Is that really what it really boils down to?
It is the money. And the government, and they've been very successful, the wind industry, in lobbying the government, and very successful in doing social marketing to make it sound as though the claims they make are real. And there's no evidence at all that they are, of course. And what's driving it? Of course, it's money. The wind industry would disappear as soon as the subsidies cease.
Go ahead, Susan.
Well, Dr. McMurtry, actually, I wanted to get, I have a burning question going back to the University of Waterloo epidemiological study, which is the Society for Wind Vigilance going to take a stand on that or make some, kind of public comment?
Well, at this point, we have been critical of the process that yielded a solar engineer as the head of it. We have been critical of how long it's taking. It would be premature to be critical of the research they're doing since we don't know exactly what the methodology is. All that's been revealed is a press release, which is an exercise in burnishing what they're doing. So that we've been asking for just exactly what is your methodology, and that has not been forthcoming.
So they're operating in secret. They're not willing to share the design of the study at this point, or?
Yeah, they will give you broad outlines, but not the detail that is so essential to making the judgment. And so to date, we have not seen a presentation or anything about the methodology of the study they're proposing.
I mean, I guess it just seems odd to me that, I mean, it seems like an important step, especially in a contentious environment like this issue is, that it would seem to behoove the folks that are doing it to reach out, to try to be inclusive, to try to be open and transparent in the process. I always brought up to believe that's what science was really, you know, that was one of the ideals of the scientific community. This seems like the opposite.
It is. It is the opposite. And in the process, they've turned the precautionary principle on its head. Their constant cry is that you haven't produced peer review evidence of harm. And, of course, that's false. And I might just mention that the Massachusetts study, the panel, managed to miss some important work in their literature review, and as far as that's concerned. So what they do is they insist on the highest standard, as judged by them, of course, for people who may complain. However, when it comes to their own assertions, for some strange reason, such standards don't exist. They have never produced any meaningful research to support their claims. They basically hire consultants who produce papers that make them look good, and that's what they're paid to do. And there's been no independent arm's length research done.
I wanted to ask you also, how is it going politically in Ontario? I mean, is it strictly on a rural versus urban line how people feel about wind turbines, or is there some crossover? Are there some people in the cities who actually recognize that these are a big problem?
I would say it is a divide. And certainly that's the way the last election went. The thing that kept the current government with a majority, but it's not an overall majority, so it's what's called a minority government. So they were returned as a minority government with the most seats. The thing that has kept them in power is the Greater Toronto Area. That's what they won those seats, which is a lot. It relates to a substantial percentage of the province. There's realization some of the smaller cities is a problem, such as Owen Sound or Kingston, but not in places like Hamilton or Oshawa or Richmond Hill or Newmarket or in all the cities surrounding Toronto. You don't hear any concerns being expressed because they're not affected. And that group represents the majority. And I'm sure that's part of the calculus that the industry has and when they do things as they do.
It's too bad that there can't be sort of a field trip program, you know, some way for the rural residents to reach out to the urban residents and invite them to come for a field trip and hang out a little bit, have a picnic.
Well, if we were going to invite urban folk, and of course I'm from a city myself, and I have all sorts of relatives, and I've been able to convince them that about the folly of the exercise.
You're doing better than Susan with her family.
Oh, you haven't had luck with your family, Susan?
Oh no, I know. No, I have a sister-in-law who has a brother who's a wind developer.
Oh well, then that would explain it, because there's major money to be made. Of course, it's about money. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're not going to convince somebody to give up an opportunity to make good bucks.
No.
But the urban people, they do want to check it out. It's not enough to simply come and visit and stand by a turbine. as some have done. What you need to do is to spend time, as people do that live near turbines, sleeping there, sleeping within 2 kilometers of turbines when the wind is blowing and when it's not, and then find out. Some people, to their surprise, have come to rural settings and found they have gotten ill, but they're too few in number.
Well, Bob, we're gonna take a break for a minute, and I'm hoping that some of our listeners will dial in to our call-in line, and we will take a few comments and questions from our listeners. There's quite a conversation going on in the chat room, and then hopefully we'll try to bring some of that into it as well. We're going to pay a few public service announcements, and we have a special treat. You know, the Oscars, the Academy Awards and all that were just a few weeks ago. One of the groups in Ontario has their own answer to that. So we're going to listen to that first, then some public service announcements, and then we're going to be right back, and hopefully we'll take some calls. The dial-in number is 213-943-3683, 213-943-3683.
Wind Concerns Ontario, in cooperation with Windwise Radio, WWR, present the first annual Golden Pinwheel Award. Now a report from our Ontario news desk. Susan, can you hear me?
Why, yes, Harley, I can hear you.
Did you interview Jane from Wind Concerns Ontario, as I assigned you?
Indeed I did, Harley.
And what did she have to say?
Well, Jane Wilson says, it is a serious business. Wind's power is being pushed through Ontario as an answer to a number of problems, but it's really a giant profit-making scheme for a few individuals and companies.
And now we join the Golden Pinwheels Award Show in progress. I am so happy to be here on stage to give out the best supporting role in a political debacle, Golden Pinwheel. Do we have the envelope, Wanda?
We sure do.
Let's see. Here it is. The big moment. And the winner is John Wilkinson, the former Minister of the Environment.
To find out how John Wilkinson won his award and to see the rest of the Golden Pinwheel Awards, visit Wind Concerns Ontario at freewco.blogspot.com.
Windfall, Laura Israel's award-winning documentary, will be shown in Shelburne, Massachusetts at Memorial Hall on Sunday, March 18th, between 4 p.m. and 6 p.m.
This in from Vermont. From Steve Wright, we are hoping you can participate in this important event that needs our presence and involvement. The event is an evening forum entitled The Future of Alternative Energy in Vermont, sponsored by Vermont Dems and featuring a number of alternative energy developers.
This forum will be held on Monday, March 12th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Marion Cross School, 22 Church Street, Norwich, Vermont. Over the next couple of days, they will be building a list of attendees and carpools. Please RSVP to salmo@vtlink.net. That's S-A-L-M-O at V-T-L-I-N-K.net. Or call. The number is area code 802-586-7705. Again, that's 802-586-7705.
Your help is needed. Please help stop the massive federal subsidies for wind energy.
The United States Senate is scheduled to vote on Tuesday, March 13th on the Stabenow Amendment, Senate 1812 to Senate 1813, which includes extensions of both the Production Tax Credit and the Section 1603 Treasury Grant Program for 1 year, contact your senators. Call the Congressional Switchboard at 202-224-3121. Again, that's 202-224-3121.
In Toronto, Ontario, on Tuesday, April 3rd, there will be a wind power convention protest. Gathering will be at 11:30 a.m., speakers at 12, protest march at 12:30 p.m. Beside the CBC building, opposite Metro Toronto Convention Center, where the FIT, fleecing individual taxpayers, convention is being held. Local groups, please coordinate buses and attendance for your own areas.
This is WWR, WinWise Radio. If your group has an announcement they'd like read on the show, please send them along, and we'd be happy to help.
Well, we are back. We are back. Hi, Dr. McMurtry, are you still with us?
I certainly am.
So we like to do these announcements for all of our listeners. People have sent them in from all over. And if anyone's listening that has some for next week, please send them along. The email address for the show is harleyandsusan@winwiseradio.org. So I wanted to ask a little bit about, it's kind of an interesting question about the response to, I guess, it seems like whenever we were talking about this earlier in the week, and you mentioned that you felt like that whenever a medical professional like yourself or Dr. Lori or Dr. Harry, Amanda, starts to get what we call in the States uppity, that there's a major response from the wind interests, the proponents of wind energy. And it seems like it's almost, I don't know, it just seems like there's an attack going on, that they don't want to know the truth. I mean, and it seems like it's very unfortunate.
Oh, of course. I mean, there's billions at stake. Ontario in the next 20 years is going to expend, according to a banker that is in our group, over, his name's Parker Gallant, by the way, over $100 billion. And social programs have been cut back. That's a huge amount of money. And if you're a developer, you want to be there with your hands up. And if somebody's trying to interfere with that or threaten it, then they're bad news. They're a bad person. And so they behave exactly that way. You're threatening our interest. You're a bad person. And they set about in every possible way to discredit or attack. And I don't think anybody's suffered any as much as Sarah Laurie recently and Nina Pierpont previously. Certainly I have been attacked, but we've been we generally send out letters threatening libel because, in fact, it could be done. And that tends to quieten things down. But what Sarah Laurie has had to go through of late is best described as appalling.
Yeah. Well, she's such a nice person too. I mean, it's just so unfortunate that
she is, and she's a very smart doctor.
Yeah, and she's just, you know, she's just trying to do the right thing, you know.
Yeah, she's telling the truth. So the whole movement is, I like to say, is not anti-wind. I love the wind. It's sound rustling in the trees. I love the wind if it stiffens the sail of my dinghy. I love the wind when it lifts the waves to the shore. I'm not anti-wind. But I am certainly pro-truth and pro-health. And those are the people that the wind industry attacks.
Well, we're going to take a call. And maybe, Bob, we'll talk about sailing sometimes. It sounds like you're a sailor, and I've done quite a bit of that myself. But we're going to take a call from Pennsylvania. Carl from Pennsylvania wants to comment a little bit, and we're gonna take him. Carl, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, Carl. Good evening.
Hi. Good. It's hi, Bob. It's Carl.
Where are you from?
So, Bob, did you recognize that caller?
Oh, yes. I know Carl Phillips very well. We were both expert witnesses in the Chatham-Kent ERT hearing, which was the largest hearing of its kind. 26 witnesses, 10 from pro-health and pro-truth side, and 16 from the wind proponent side. And so there was where the rubber hit the road and the truth was challenged, and people were under cross-examination. And the finding of that tribunal was that there was indeed adverse health effects, that the debate should be over about that. But there is a matter of degree. How severe is it? And Carl was part of that, and so certainly I know him.
Excellent. Well, Carl, we're curious to hear what you have to share.
Sure. First off, I wanted to assure Bob and anybody else who knows me that I actually am still working on this issue, even though you haven't heard anything new from me for quite a while. We're hoping to get a study into the field pretty soon. Can't say much about it right now, but just wanted to point that out. But I got a practical question for you, which is that I've been dealing with a community group here, my church specifically here where I live, and it's a let's call it a lefty population that is into this idea that supporting wind power is a good idea, and actually like steer money toward the industry of all the ridiculous things. And I have been struggling to try to get them to realize the truth of this, and it's the most bizarre experience, because of course I've been working on this. I have obviously a fair bit of expertise, but I can't get much leverage. You, on the other hand, have been working on it as both a scientist and an advocate for longer than I have, and I was wondering if you had any suggestions there.
I think the most compelling thing would be for them to meet with or hear from victims and to hear how their lives have been disrupted, and to hear how in one family I can recall, because I've met and dealt with at least 40 of these victims, one family where the grandparents were adversely affected, and certainly the grandfather feels that the premature death of his wife at 53 was related to all the stress that she was experiencing, that the next generation had problems with the wife was pregnant and she was having threatened abortion. She was, she was bleeding a bit and wanted a baby. And they told her to move away from turbines. She did and secured a healthy boy. And that the third generation, their daughter, age 3, was screaming in the night with ear pain that disappeared when she went away from the turbines. Ear pain that was investigated 11 times in emergency departments, and they found no other cause for it, no middle ear infection, for example, which would be a common cause. So they need to hear about those stories and about other stories and how their lives have been turned upside down. And as one woman put it, Tracy Vann, and she's willing to be quoted, what was once paradise is now a living hell because of the influx of the turbines. They need to hear from real people suffering real issues that were unprecedented in their lives, that were better when they went away from turbines, and were worse every time they came back near home. That's called crossover, as you taught me, Carl. And the other striking thing about it is that they had revealed preference where they would rather sleep away from home because of all the difficulty they were getting into. There are very few, if any, illnesses that will cause you to prefer to be away from your own bed and away from your own home. And, for example, sleep in your son's trailer, in the case of one woman whom I know very well. So they need to hear about those very real human stories, and I think that is what's likely to reach them, because all these people, without exception, were pro-turbine until they experienced what happens when they live too close. And they changed.
Hey, Carl, this is Harley. I had a question for you. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it, but or whether you're willing to answer this, but I want to ask you anyway. How do you feel that your work was treated by the so-called experts panel that the Mass Department of Environmental Protection and Department of Public Health released back in January of this year? I know that it was cited, but I'm not sure whether they really had. So I'm kind of curious what you thought about that.
Yeah, exactly. It's cited, but the citing is kind of a joke. I have to admit, I haven't made as careful a study of the Massachusetts report as I did of some others, like the Ontario medical officers. But it's pretty clear that, you know, the game is to cite everything and then say, oh, look, we did a comprehensive review. And you say, okay, but you ignored this evidence. Oh, no, look, it's right there in the references. I mean, it's comical. I mean, they ignored it. I mean, there was no recognition, not like the recognition I just got. Thank you, Bob. I appreciate the use of the terms crossover and reveal preference. Nothing is more gratifying to a researcher and author to I'm guessing that you learned both of those from me. So, but no. It's a complete joke. There's no indication at all that I saw in that document. Again, I haven't made a Talmudic study of it, but there's no indication there, just like there wasn't in the Ontario Chief Medical Officer's document, that they actually paid any attention to this enormous amount of, you know, adverse event reporting with crossover reports, which is, you know, in my mind as an epidemiologist, the overwhelmingly compelling evidence. So I just don't understand how everyone can consistently get away with it, but since they realize that they can, that's what they keep doing.
It almost seems to me like there's an epidemiology of that could be done, a study done on the disease of these so-called expert panels ignoring evidence. It's almost like that. It seems like it's like a cluster.
I think you're totally right. There's an interesting something interesting to be written there. There actually is a bit of a science in epidemiology, led by some people who used to be at the U.S. National Cancer Institute, that's been on exactly that topic, and the behavior of these expert panels. Let me interject here, because I know at some point you'll want to cut me off as a caller. I really like the suggestion, of course, of getting real live people on the stage there, and of course I have plenty of written evidence along those lines, but that wasn't winning the day. So if anybody in the sound of our voice is within driving distance of the western Philadelphia suburbs and would be willing to be that witness, please let me know. You can look me up on the internet. Thanks.
You know, Carl, another thing you can try doing is seeing if you can get a hold of a copy of Windfall, and I'm sure Harley knows how to do that or knows somebody who knows how to get you a copy of Windfall, the movie by Laura Israel, and show that at your church, because that has, it's very powerful. It opens minds, and it has a lot of footage with people living surrounded by wind turbines and going through a lot of hardship because of it.
Yeah.
I can attest. I saw it at in the Toronto Film Festival, the Windfall, and Laura Israel was there to answer questions. And that is very powerful. And I would commend that recommendation to you.
Well, thank you very much for calling in, Carl, and I hope you'll continue to tune in. And any suggestions you have for improvement and for anyone that's listening, or suggestions for things to do on our show, we'd be glad to hear that. And I'm going to take the next caller. This is Barb from Ontario, and she has a question for us. Barb, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Hi, Barb. What part of Ontario are you from?
Orangeville area. We were in the Shelburne Wind Farm, and we had to move out. We got quite ill. And I just wanted to, I've been quite involved in this because what's going on is so, so very wrong. And I wanted to let you know, anybody who seems to come forward that has, it doesn't matter what their credentials are, it doesn't matter how much research they've done, whether they're first-hand experience, they're always labeled anti-wind. And it is so hard because the government and the wind developers are so tight together that they have this this hold over the population that green energy is wonderful. We thought wind turbines were wonderful too. We welcomed them into our area. And only until what happened to us did we realize what was actually going on, and we started connecting with other people. And the deceit by the government and the wind companies is, it's overwhelming, and it's very, very hard to get the message out because we're always labeled anti-wind, and it's the furthest thing from the truth.
Hmm. Bob, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, well, I think I may know Barbara, and she's a spectacular person who's been very courageous in this whole activity. And she's absolutely right, and she herself has been assailed by the wind industry and called out as not, you know, telling the truth and so forth. That is her standard operating procedure. And she and her husband have really been very, you know, been through an awful lot, and as far as I know, neither one of them are whole, even though they've moved away from them. They still suffer from some adverse effects.
Are you still, is that true, Barbara? Are you still?
I don't know how any family honestly can heal from this until there's an acknowledgement of what they've done to people. We're one of many, many families, and most people are afraid to speak publicly because they have their property values on the line. They have the community who have been so greenwashed, they don't even know it, but they are. And if somebody comes out speaking against this whole thing, they are frowned upon. They are chided. Like, it's, I have to admit, when I first saw the wind turbines that were in phase one of where we were living, I thought they were wonderful. I thought they were majestic. I thought they were incredible. And not until they actually started up and we were hit immediately with the sleep deprivation, and as we went on, we got so ill. And we had no idea. And so I can understand why people don't believe it, because they do look wonderful, but the noise, the whoosh, the blade turning, the low-frequency vibration coming off of them, it is real, and it is horrible.
So, I wanted to ask.
If I could just say something about the wind industry's practices. They really make a very big practice out of stereotyping people. So people who are anti-wind are NIMBYs, or nut bars, or liars, or whatever. They always do that. Now, this is, stereotyping is bigotry. That's what stereotyping is. They're one and the same. You can't have bigotry without stereotyping. And the wind industry uses stereotyping as their standard stock and trade.
No, yeah. It is terrible. As I said, I've been experiencing it with my own family, and it's pretty rough. Barb, I wanted to ask you, when you said that you had that you guys got really ill, what sort of things did you experience?
Well, the worst part was the sleep deprivation. That was pretty much immediate. We had headaches. First of all, I'll say we were healthy individuals, not on any medications, no pre-existing conditions. And we could not sleep night after night after night, and it doesn't take very long to get ill. By the end of it, we had, with the headaches, we had heart palpitations. My husband's thyroid level went off the charts. He had to see a specialist. He's never had that happen before. I've got it all diarized. It was absolutely terrible. I couldn't even work, literally, because I could not. The cognitive function was gone. I couldn't remember things. I couldn't even speak properly with my work. But the worst part of it is the lack of acknowledgement, the disrespect from the government. I wrote Dr. Arlene King. She's the chief medical officer of health. I wrote her before her literature review was was sent out, and I told her about the people across the province, because we did go public and we had people phoning us and people dropping into our house and saying, what are we going to do? And I'm saying, call your member of parliament or your provincial parliament, and people weren't getting anywhere. Nobody was doing anything for anyone. And sorry, I lost my train of thought there.
So you ended up, I mean, it sounds like all of you just have this complete sense of powerlessness and abandonment, really. I mean, you've been abandoned by the government that's supposed to be protecting you as a citizen of your country.
Absolutely.
Not only abandoned, but attacked. That's the worst of it. I mean, they're not only abandoned but and ignored, but they are positively made to feel like they're not telling the truth. Their suffering is invalidated. Actively invalidated.
It's absolutely horrible.
Yeah, that's really, really bad. Harley and I did have the pleasure, the people who I don't know, what would you say, fostered this ridiculous so-called study of adverse health effects from wind turbines in the state of Massachusetts.
Yeah.
The guy who spearheaded that study had to sit through hours of testimony from people in the state of Massachusetts who were just ranting and raving at him about how sick they've been and how horrible this experience has been. And we got to watch him just squirm and squirm and look so uncomfortable. And that was kind of great.
But I don't think that sort of retribution does much good. You know, I mean, if it's not effective in changing the policy, then we're not, you know, that's the thing.
Well, the fact of the matter is, where we are in Massachusetts is we don't know if that's been effective or not, because there were so many people at these hearings, the press showed up. So then it was all over the press. And at least publicly, these people responsible for this dreadful study said that, you know, they were going to take very seriously the testimony of the people that were having a hard time and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, who knows? I don't know.
Dr. King was, as I said, I'd written her letters before she released her literature review explaining the people in the province that were having problems. And she would not meet with me. I wanted to talk to her about these people, about myself, about our family, and she would not meet with us. And I have a series of 3 to 4 letters going back and forth before the literature review was released. And I don't know what kind of chief medical officer of health ignores people who are having issues in something like this and goes ahead and releases a literature review saying there are no problems. Like, She's a person in the trust of the public. We trust her. We look up to her as a somebody who's going to look after our health and not put us in any danger, and here she is ignoring what's going on.
In the very moment of when she should be reaching out to lift you up instead. And it's just it's maddening, and it makes me very angry, and my heart goes out to you. I can't even imagine having to, you know, leave your home and be sick and have that happen to you on top of it. It's just a horrible situation. Horrible.
All the so-called doctors who have been part of any of these reports have not ever engaged with the victims. And indeed, when invited to, such as Arlene King was, or others, they have refused routinely.
Yeah, I mean, here in Massachusetts, that was definitely the case. They've been trying in Falmouth, Massachusetts, for a long time now to try to get them to even just come and talk, you know, and they won't do it. They just
they're fearful of what the public will say, and they know they have the support of the industry, and they know they have the support of the government. And so they run to that shelter and then produce what they do. And if any of them are listening to me at this moment, I would comment that I don't know how you can call yourself a physician
and make judgments about people without actually evaluating them clinically. To do so is a compromise of your integrity.
Well, I think on that note, I see by the clock that we're out of time. Barb, thank you very much for participating in the show, and we're going to return to all these issues in Ontario over the next month or two, at least a couple of times on the show, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk more with you. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much.
A pleasure. And thank you, Anne, as well. It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that wraps up another show, doesn't it?
Yep. So thank you so much, Dr. McMurtry.
Well, we have some interesting shows coming up next week. We return to Vermont, where we're going to have a conversation with a couple of very brilliant women. The first is Sue Morse, who is a wildlife tracker, naturalist, and biologist of pretty well known. And also we're going to have Annette Smith from Vermonters for a Clean Environment, who's involved in the struggle against industrial wind turbines there. What do you think, Susan?
I think it's going to be really great. These are both amazing, amazing people.
Yes. And thank you very much to all of our listeners, and especially to Dr. McMurtry for generously donating his time this evening and for all of the work that he's doing. Good night from WindWise Radio.